This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Later, we'll run through the day's top local stories, from Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino and his crew making their return to Chicago, to the stalled budget battle at Chicago City Hall, to an interesting study on alcohol use in Illinois. We'll break down those stories and more. But first, if you have been thinking about putting solar panels on your home, well, there's something that you should know. President Trump's Big Beautiful Bill is cutting federal tax credits for solar installation, and the last day to apply is in just 2 weeks. Well, that's the not so great news, but there is a silver lining. Even as federal incentives shrink, Illinois is still doubling down on clean energy, offering grants to help residents, municipalities, and organizations make that switch. And some local companies aren't just installing panels, they're building up the workforce that'll power the future. So next, we're going to hear from a pair of experts about what's ahead for solar technology in our region. At the table, we had Senyo Adore, co-founder of Cesenergy Eco Solutions Enterprise, and Karen Weigert, who's director of Loyola University Chicago's Baumhart Center for Social Enterprise and Responsibility. Senyo, we're hearing reports, and I'm not surprised at all, of folks kind of just scrambling to get solar installed right now. This is since, as I mentioned, the passage of that big, beautiful bill. So what has that meant for you and your business? Everyone's trying to head to your store for December 31st?
100%. I mean, I think scrambling is the right word. Mm-hmm. Folks are moving quickly to try to either move projects along or safe harbor the projects as much as possible, which means that putting down about 5% of the cost of the entire system has to be executed before December 31st, 2025.
Wow.
Or else that 30% it goes away.
Yeah. So, yeah, families get or could get up to 30% off the cost of installation or equipment back through the credit, right?
That is correct.
Tell me how that has worked out in practical terms. What has that meant for folks?
So if we talk about just simple payback period, right? If you're doing a direct purchase of a system, that 30% is the difference of recovering your cost between 8 to 9 years versus 13 to 14 years. So a very significant difference in the payback period.
Interesting. Yeah, Karen, talk more about the role that these tax credits, you know, of this kind, 30% off. I mean, it sounds massive to me, but yeah, what role have they played in sort of helping folks transition to solar?
Yeah, the numbers are significant. And there have been tax credits for solar more or less for a couple decades for residents. They essentially try to improve affordability, make it easier to install, which then grows the market, which then starts to create a pathway for companies and for economies of scale. So it is really trying to accelerate the adoption of a technology that technically is working, and the economics have to catch up.
So have we seen sort of a steady increase? You said that these credits or credits of this kind or a similar kind have been available for the better part of a decade. But have we seen a steady sort of increase in folks being interested in the switch?
Yeah, we've seen tremendous growth in solar, actually.
Yeah, I know anecdotally, like around me, I've seen family and friends catch on. You know, after 2020, I saw people really jump out? You're both nodding.
Yeah.
is there something there?
Sure. I mean, I think the popularizing of the Climate and Equity Jobs Act and coming through Springfield really kind of stimulated the economy. And I think from a public perception perspective, it took solar out of the realm of a hobbyist kind of exercise and into something that was more practical and accessible.
Yes. I'm glad you said that, because for a while I looked at it like, okay, that's cool, but it's probably not for me.
Exactly. You know,
that's so for someone who's really into this stuff.
Nerds like us, right? it's essentially. But I mean, I think practically speaking, there are different nodes in the ecosystem that have to be activated, right? So from a market standpoint, you have to be able to accessibly get the deal done and through the door. The 30% helps that piece, right?
Yes.
But afterwards, we need to support workforce development in those spaces, because one of the largest threats to the industry is workforce competence, right? So being able to raise the standard of laborers in the space has been an initiative of DCEO and the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity through Springfield. And I think altogether it works to kind of keep the industry up.
Interesting. So, you know, 2 weeks until the end of the year, right? So time is of the essence here. Is it too late, Senyo, make that clear. Is it too late for people to take advantage of this tax credit?
Get it while it's hot, right? It's that kind of thing. But you do have what I mentioned before, a way to safe harbor the projects, right? And what that means is through a solar developer or contractor, you have to at least have, there's two ways to go at it, right? Mm-hmm. Have the structural work actually done, which means some of the racking systems you see on roofs have to be actually completed and installed by a certain period of time. And then the other piece is 5% of the contract value has to be transacted before December 31st, 2025.
Okay, so just the fact that this deadline is pressing, I gather it changes at least the way you've been talking to your customers about their options.
100%, yeah. You know, and we want them to stay encouraged, because there's a lot in the space that Illinois is doing to support clean energy as a whole, right? But when it comes to residential solar specific, we are in a crunch. So I do want to be transparent about that reality.
Sure. Karen, some predictions are saying that the end of this credit on December 31st is going to decrease demand and actually drive prices down.
I think we're going to have to watch. I'd certainly see that the near-term projections that I'm seeing tend to predict that there will be a decrease in demand. Mm-hmm. And the cost side is mixed of those hard costs, which is like the panels and the equipment to hold them, and then the soft costs, which is the design, the installation. So there's a couple different elements there, but a decrease in demand will probably put some downward price pressure near term. It's going to put tremendous pressure on the industry here. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is, what are the long-term fundamentals in residential solar? And the long-term fundamentals in residential solar seem pretty strong. Mm. And some of that comes from volatility on electricity prices. How can a resident control that? Well, if you have solar, you've locked in in your economics
the
for
long-term
decades.
Fundamentals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Say more on that.
So these are the questions of, is it a viable technology? Yes. Can it add value to you as a resident when you think about your home? It can. And that value can be economic. And that's really protecting yourself against electricity price spikes, which has been what's driving a lot of policy in Illinois right now. But if you have solar, you're probably going to have those panels for several decades. You now know your energy costs largely for decades, and you're protected from all of that. And then you can add things like, if you've got a battery backup system attached to it, now your home is resilient. Now you don't have to worry about blackouts. So there's a lot of value proposition here that is really strong if we look at it overall. And all of that gets you carbon benefits, but it gives you personal benefits in having a kind of system like this. So we're going to have to really watch to see where the economics go near term and long.
Senyo is smiling and nodding. I got to find out why.
100%. I mean, I see it the same way. If we're looking at first cost benefits, you can have a dystopian view of you know, what's to come. But if you're looking at things holistically, and you model essentially what the state is looking to do, right, by pulling forward energy storage policy, it's supporting community solar. Well, think about that in terms of the infrastructure at the residential level, mm-hmm. right? When you look at the residential installs, you can support that resiliency through battery backup and storage that way as well. So, you know, when you're in times where the door-to-door kind of economics don't necessarily make sense, mm-hmm. you default to programmatic so that you can leverage kind of community benefits in terms of resiliency.
So, Senyo, if demand does go down, that, back to that question I asked Karen a moment ago, if demand does go down, how's that going to affect your business?
So for our business specifically, we'll feel the constriction in the marketplace, yeah. right?
There's like no, if not enough people are buying solar.
There's no way around that, right? But I think, I'm an eternal optimist, right? So saying no way around it is a bit loaded. But I think moving away from direct purchase models and maybe into more consumer-focused lease models and power purchase agreements might be a tool that can be leveraged to still get folks, especially in the low to medium income realm, mm-hmm. Involved with the solar installations. You have incentive-based programs like Illinois Shines and Illinois Solar for All. They are competitive procurement programs, but it's still provides a space to, you know, leverage some state-based incentives to move these projects right. forward. So, you know, that's kind of our focus now is maybe reducing our shot group to a more kind of tighter field as opposed to serving as broad of a market that we've right. been serving in the past.
Glad you brought up that group. We reached out to the Illinois Power Agency, which oversees the Illinois Solar for All program. And in a statement we got back, it reads in part, quote, despite federal policy shifts, ILSFA, so the Illinois Solar for All program, will continue to make solar affordable for the communities and populations that have faced barriers to participating in this green energy economy. So I want to hear from you both. Is that good news? What does a message like that signal to you, Karen?
Yeah, it signals a lot of the policy backdrop that has been supported by residents across the state. Illinois has passed three huge pieces of energy legislation in the last decade, FEJA, CEJA, and SERJA, the most recent one just this fall.
The fact that you're keeping up with these acronyms is...
Yeah,
is
you gotta just say them pretty quickly.
Incredible.
But what it speaks to is that there's a lot of activity on the ground here, and there's a lot of political support, which has translated into policy support over time. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're seeing from the IPA. You know, they're working in that policy-developed environment, and that has created support for solar broadly, for decarbonizing the energy system broadly, and for extending into things like battery storage overall. So that programmatic effort has led to their work, and it puts them in a space where they can actually see some forward momentum, which is something that we'll be seeing statewide. And there's specific supports for communities that have fewer resources. And I think that's also really embedded in that comment from them.
Yeah, Senyo, there are still some state grants, right, available for municipalities and for the homeowners and businesses to install solar. So that's promising.
Yeah, 100%. And I think if you're, you know, serious about, you know, standing in the gap for these programs, then leveraging, you know, these grants that come out of, you know, DCEO, for example, the Energy Equity Futures Grant or the Community Sovereignty Grant, mm-hmm. right? These are all tools that can be leveraged to, again, bring about some financial structuring support to move a lot of these projects forward that otherwise might be impacted by that sunsetting of the 30% ITC.
As a business owner, how do you think about the product lines that you're offering in a time like this?
Yeah, so I think from a residential perspective, right, it gets pretty tough to do the door-to-door solar installation to the degree that we can leverage state-based grants to essentially offset kind of the deficit that we experienced through that ITC going away will support those particular projects. I think one thing that we can point residents to is participating in community solar programs, though, because that is already coming out of your utility bill, right? You're already paying into that that RPS portfolio. Right. So being able to kind of participate in those programs can allow you to realize some benefits that may not necessarily be on your roof, but you can buy into, you know, a group buy program and still achieve some benefits that way. Putting folks into in energy efficiency programs, right, where they're reducing their consumption overall is another way to look at, you know, strategically impacting your holistic energy footprint and what that means for your bottom line. So there's still some products out there that we can kind of evangelize to help folks, you know, realize some value in the ecosystem.
And we're running out of time. I wish we had time to go into, because you're super impressive, Senor. You're also focused on the workforce development piece of this, right? Because you're making sure people who have been overburdened by environmental racism can actually enter this green energy workforce. I think back to our conversation, Karen, a couple of months ago on In the Loop, we talked about the end of federal tax credits for EVs, for electric vehicles. Does this feel the same?
There are a lot of similarities in the sense of financial support for a technology that is consumer facing, that someone could purchase for their life or their home. So I certainly see a lot of similarities there.
Right.
You know, there's some differences in the actual product, and you experience a car regularly when you drive it. You don't see your solar panels as much.
Right.
But this idea of what can an individual do for their transition into clean energy, these are putting some financial roadblocks.
I was curious.
It's impressive to hear some of the pathways.
So to sum things up, the federal tax credit for solar installation is expiring on the 31st of December, but there are still several ways that the state of Illinois is investing in solar technology and making sure that residents get those benefits. We've been chatting with Senio Adore, who's co-founder of Cess Energy Eco Solutions Enterprise, and Karen Weigert, our sustainability contributor. Thank you both so much.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Okay, now it's time to get into the top local stories of the day. At the table to help me break them down was Claire Lane, WBEZ Morning Edition anchor, Chip Mitchell, WBEZ's criminal justice reporter, and politics editor Dave McKinney joined us remotely as he made his way into the studio. Dave kicked things off with that City Hall drama.
Well, I think things are very much up in the air. I mean, we're kind of at a stage where neither side, neither the mayor nor this group of alders who have an alternative budget plan are showing any signs of willing to budge. I mean, there's an important committee hearing today. The City Council Budget Committee is going to hear this competing proposal to the mayors, and it very likely will pass out of committee, setting the stage later this week for a vote on this alternative plan that Mayor Johnson has threatened to veto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a reminder, you know, this what's happening now is not what we're used to, right? Because mayors have long controlled the budget process here in Chicago, but it feels a little bit different this year. What's happening, right, Dave?
That's very true. I mean, the fact is, you've got right now it appears, at least 26 alders. That's more than half the city council aligned in a competing budget plan. And I mean, this idea that's being floated right now by the alders that are opposed to the mayor, you know, it involves increasing the city's liquor tax, in plastic bag fee, selling ad space mm-hmm. on city light poles, various things like that. And it's all around trying to get rid of this head tax, the corporate head tax that the mayor has floated, and that is quite unpopular on the city council.
Yeah, something else that's been unpopular, Claire, is the idea of a property tax increase. We've talked a lot about Mayor Johnson saying, I'm not making that happen, right? But now it seems to be on the table, albeit a very small one. Is that right?
Yes, this is for library services. Okay. And this is the Chicago City Council's Finance Committee that's given just the initial approval so far to a very slight, as you mentioned, property tax increase to just maintain our library services for next year. This is even after Alders expressed contempt, as well as Mayor Brandon Johns, for hiking property taxes mm-hmm. this budget season and last season, we should mention. So proponents of the increase estimate it would cost average homeowners roughly $12 more per year on that tax bill, though that number has not been verified by the city's budget office just yet. And yesterday's vote on this, again, it's just one step of the many required to actually adopt this increase.
Right, right. Chip, in other news, Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino is back. He's back in Chicago,
indeed,
back in Little Village. What are he and those federal agents doing?
Well, I think at root, what is going on is the Trump administration is sending a message to the public that it's not letting up on deportations.
This is not over.
Yeah, they've sent out signals before that we would see another surge in immigration enforcement, this deportation blitz that really ramped up in September. And we have to keep in mind as well that the deportation blitz has actually never stopped. Mm-hmm. You know, it has, to a large extent, left the headlines. But Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents have continued making arrests every day throughout the Chicago area.
Yeah.
Now, Gregory Bovino, he's the chief of patrol of nationally of the U.S. Border Patrol, and he's going around city to city leading these deportation blitzes. He's been gone for 2 months. He came back in with as many as a couple hundred agents. You know, he came in with 100, and 100 Border Patrol agents were already here. That's what we're estimating right now.
Really?
And they were very busy yesterday in both Cicero and Little Village. It was kind of like, you know, returning to their old haunts.
So people were detained yesterday.
Oh, yeah. 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 We're hearing at least 15 people detained, starting with day laborers, in front of the big box stores along Cicero Avenue, moving into Little Village, tooling around Little Village in a caravan of 10 SUVs and stopping and giving chase, as I've seen personally a couple months ago, giving chase to people for no apparent reason other than that they ran. And then the Border Patrol agents go after them, arrest them. And so they made, we're hearing about 15 arrests yesterday.
What was the reaction from community members yesterday? I can imagine some surprise. As you said, yes, the immigration enforcement hasn't actually stopped. But seeing Greg Bovino and his crew in particular back in town, that must have been shocking.
Yeah, it is a shock. And we didn't get any wind of this until the night before. So that would be Monday night. And yeah, in the community, yeah, there is shock. He's been through these communities, both Cicero and Little Village, and they've used chemical munitions on a number of dates. There's been all sorts of conflict. There have been extended standoffs. Mm-hmm. So this is quite rattling. I spoke with a shopkeeper. She runs a little corner store on a very quiet block of Little Village. She depends on people coming in from the neighborhood all day long, buying things, tortillas,
right,
buying junk food, beverages, whatever. She said her business after this caravan of 10 vehicles went through was basically non-existent. And I saw that. I was there with her for about an hour. I only saw like one customer.
Deciding to stay home. Yeah,
right.
For obvious reasons. And part of the surprise too, Chip, is because, you know, when Bovino and his crew left, they went to Charlotte and, you know, other cities and started making headlines with aggressive enforcement in those places. And they said that they wouldn't be coming back to the Chicago area until the spring. That's what we had heard, you know, them coming back fourfold, maybe March. So now, you know, we haven't even hit official winter yet and they're back. I mean, any surprise to you, Claire?
It's just all part of the fear tactics, the intimidation campaign. All of this PR and marketing. I mean, there were videos being posted yesterday, reporters just asking Bovin. He's like a character in this story that's, in his mind, it's like he's playing a role, but it's impacting people's lives here in Chicago. Great tape from Chip this morning talking to the shop leader, too. I mean, people don't want to feel afraid. Christmas is next week.
Right.
Yeah, and it's interesting because not only Gregory Bovino, he's been very good at cultivating a lot of news media attention, but they have their own crew that follows them around, and they make videos.
These are
Hollywood standard videos that they'll make, and they'll release on social media, and they get hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of views. Yeah. So that's what's going on.
Dave, what comes to mind for you here as we're back in Bovino territory, it seems?
Well, I mean, there's no direct, you know, provable connection, but I do think the timing of this is also kind of interesting that, you know, a couple of our colleagues at Chicago Public Media, Dan Mihalopoulos and Lauren Fitzpatrick, wrote an expansive profile on Gregory Bovino that basically exposed his family tree and, you know, laid out how, you know, he is a descendant of immigrants and, you know, went to his hometown, talked to folks that were, you know, from his part of the world and people who were very critical of him. And I can't help but think that you know, even though Bovino would not talk to our reporters for that piece, it probably is something he saw. So I think the timing of that here just a few days later is quite curious.
Let's pivot, Claire, because we've got more vaccine news here. Illinois is recommending that hepatitis B shot. Right?
Yes. Illinois' Vaccine Advisory Committee, this is where we're at now, voted yesterday to reaffirm that it will continue to practice giving the hepatitis B vaccine to all stable newborns. So the guidance now goes to the Illinois Department of Public Health, which earlier this month said it would continue to do this, continue to recommend this vaccine. Illinois' move once again, you know, puts it at odds with federal health officials. As we remember, the CDC Advisory Committee voted early this month on the 5th of December to end its longstanding recommendation to give newborns the vaccine, which, you know, essentially is just preventing liver infection and other chronic diseases. But the chair here in Illinois of this committee says she does not see any evidence that warranted the change to this vaccine recommendation. So still going to be available to newborns in Illinois.
And more health news. The Illinois Department of Public Health has released its first ever study of alcohol use in the state. What did it find?
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. The IDPH report shows that more than 2,300 deaths statewide, so this is looking at data from 2020 to 2023, were directly related to chronic alcohol use and due to issues like liver disease and alcohol dependency syndrome. Also found in 2022, 37% of fatal crashes involved alcohol, which is a jump from just 33% back in 2019.
Yeah. Dave, in about 10 minutes on In the Loop, we're going to be talking with members of Chicago's Jewish community, and we're discussing, you know, what's going through their minds right now. This is in the wake of Sunday's deadly mass shooting overseas, where we saw 15 dead, dozens wounded. It was an anti-Semitic attack, clearly. How is Governor Pritzker reacting to this?
Well, I mean, I think with great sadness, as you know, many, many people are. You know, the governor is the third Jewish governor in Illinois history. And on the same day that he was scheduled to light a menorah at the executive mansion, he had to confront this kind of familiar storyline of attacks on Jewish communities around the world. Mm-hmm. And he called the attack horrific, and he encouraged fellow office holders and people in all forms of life, public life, personal life, to speak out against it.
Speaking of Pritzker, he was also busy signing a massive transit overhaul bill. It was passed during the fall veto session. Can you just remind us what the legislation is going to do, Dave?
Well, I mean, you know, the public transit that Chicagoans and suburbanites rely upon every day to get, you know, to and from work was facing an enormous financial cliff, about $1.5 billion that was nowhere to be found unless the legislature and governor took action. And they did so earlier this year. And as you mentioned, Pritzker signed this legislation yesterday. And what it does is it authorizes a 45-cent increase in tolls in the Illinois State Toll Highway Authority. It also it provides you know, for an increase in the sales tax in Cook and the Collar counties by a quarter of one percentage point to help fund the continued operations of the CTA, Metra, and PACE. Yeah. So for a short term here, we've got life moving forward with mass transit.
Yeah. Yeah. This certainly ends years of debate over how to finance and govern the CTA, Metra, and PACE, because all three have really been struggling to bounce back ever since the COVID-19 pandemic. What else are you watching, Claire?
Well, we know it's been a snowy start to the winter season, though not yet winter. We know it's been a cold start, but latest from the National Weather Service is no Bing Crosby. We are not going to have a white Christmas.
But
we're actually probably going to be in the 50s tomorrow.
Oh, I was going to have Ethan, our engineer, cue the music, too.
And then, well, you can still play the tunes, and you can imagine a white Christmas, but we're likely going to be in the mid-30s next week, mid to upper 30s, so no snow for Santa.
Let's get back to immigration enforcement, Chip. Do we know if Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino and other agents plan to stay in Chicago? So they popped up yesterday. What's next?
Well, we've heard this visit might be just a few days this week, and then he would go presumably back to New Orleans, but the feds have not made any announcement, a formal announcement to that effect. You know, these guys are a lot of them, the crew that he's traveling with, a lot of them come from Southern California and their holidays. So we'll see just how how the DHS, Department of Homeland Security, handles its employees over the holidays. It would be quite a Christmas that would befall many Chicagoans if they stay here through the holidays.
You remember the time when we thought, oh, no, there's no way they'd come back now. It's too cold in Chicago, right? I saw them well-equipped with their gloves and everything.
I saw the Border Patrol issues actual warm coats.
Really? Well, nice. That's good for them. But, you know, Chip, thinking about you as someone who's been, I mean, you've been covering this since, you know, day one, right? Reporting on Operation Midway Blitz all the way throughout. What goes through your mind as you see them back in town? I mean, is there any part of you that thinks we can expect more of these random pop-up visits?
Well, I don't think it would be a surprise now that they are willing to bring in a plane load of Gregory Bovino and Border Patrol agents. They've been warning us. There have been signals that have been coming for quite some time that there will be another immigration enforcement surge.
Yeah.
Our colleague John Seidel reported out a story based on his sources that they could be coming back as early as March with four times as many Border Patrol agents as they had in September and October here.
Yes, we'd better be ready.
Yeah, right. So that, you know, we'd be talking about, you know, something like 800, even 1,000 Border Patrol agents if that were to actually play out. Right now there's a lot of anxiety and it's spreading. I'll just say my family is very secure and we're not suffering anything at all like families that have been torn apart during this deportation blitz. But my wife is an immigrant. You know, she is a naturalized citizen here for 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
She is now a little bit nervous about going out in the car.
Yeah.
You know, she has dark, wheat-colored skin, as she says, and she's now carrying, again, her copies of her passport and her naturalization certificate. And somebody with brown skin who speaks with a little bit of an accent is exactly the kind of person that gets detained in this deportation blitz. So the anxiety and the fear radiates out very broadly.
Geez, what a time, what a time. Before we wrap, Dave, this is kind of an interesting one. I mean, our colleague Bob Hergeth from the Sun-Times reports that Chicagoans stepped up to support candidates in the New York City mayoral race. And so the largest amount of donations went to Zohran Mamdani, who we know is the new mayor-elect, followed by Cuomo. Is this a normal thing? Do Chicagoans normally do this, step up and support other candidates in other big political races?
Yeah, it's not unusual, Sasha. You know, in this case, as you mentioned, $70,000 to all the candidates in this field. I mean, Mamdani, I think Hergeth showed, got $36,000, mm-hmm. Compared to $24,000 for Cuomo. You know, all you have to do is, if you have clicked on one you know, email or website that has sort of a political orientation, you know, before you know it, your email queue is filled with solicitations for political donations. So, you know, I think this is a reflection partly of that, that people, you know, these campaigns are looking for money from all sources. But, you know, there's also kind of an interesting part here, too, that, you know, Mamdani ideologically is not that far apart from Mayor Brandon Johnson. And so the two of them share, you know, share views on an array of things. And so I think you probably saw some people in Chicago aligned with Johnson saying, well, we like this guy in New York as well. So that's kind of what was going on there. I mean, just added context. I mean, you look at somebody like J.B. Pritzker. I mean, I just punched his numbers into the Board of Elections website yesterday to see how, you know, the kind of donations he had gotten since running for governor back in 2017. I mean, he's gotten $500,000 from people in California. So it shows
that
people around the country are coming here and we're interested in what's going on elsewhere.
For sure. We're paying attention. That's for sure. WBEZ's Dave McKinney, Claire Lane, and Chip Mitchell.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/intheloop. Thanks for listening.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely